It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, the United States Patent and Trademark Office is canceling six of the trademarks belonging to Washington's professional football team. We'll find out what that could mean for the future of the organization and its controversial logo.
But first, NPR's quiz program, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, is in town today to record their weekly show before a live audience at Madison's Overture Center.
This week, Wisconsinites will get to be made fun of as they test their knowledge against some of the brightest in the news and entertainment world, all while trying to figure out which facts are real and which not on segments like Bluff the Listener.
Rob talked with host Peter Sagal and panelist Maz Gibrani earlier this week about the pressures of being funny and about what humor they expect to find among the brats, the beer, and the cheeseheads in Wisconsin.
Peter, welcome.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
And Maz, welcome for the first time to Central Time.
I'm happy to be there.
Well, Peter, 16 seasons of Wait, Wait, if I have that right. How do you stay funny? How do you keep the funny coming?
I'm sorry, seasons are for pikers. Seasons are for amateurs. You're talking 16 years.
Years.
We don't take any time off. This is 52 weeks a year, give or take about 8 weeks. So yeah, years, my friend.
Well, that multiplies my question. How do you stay funny for that long?
You're implying that I'm funny to begin with. the trick is to set a very low standard when you start, and people just really reconcile themselves to it.
Well, and we're public radio people. We'll laugh at anything, right?
Pretty much, just to be polite. I mean, you know, no, really, like at the end of the show, like, instead of people applauding, they go, no, that was fine. Oh, yeah, that was good. Oh, yeah, you did a great job. That's public radio applause.
Well, Maz, what Peter could have done there was say, oh, we have really great panelists.
I know, you see?
Yeah.
No credit. I mean, I'm in on these seasons as well. I mean, of course, I come and go. I'm more like the panelists were like Navy SEALs. We come in, we do our thing, we head out. But I think the key is that we record, what, like 8 hours, and then we squeeze out a 45-minute shot of that?
Pretty much. It's pretty much like a Robert Wilson opera, one of those eight-hour things, and you just get the highlights. Actually, you know what it's like World Cup soccer in that, you know, it's 90 minutes. World Cup soccer is like 90 minutes, and then you can see the whole game in like 30 seconds of a highlight reel. That's sort of what we do. We record an awful lot, and then we just broadcast the highlights.
Maz, you're a panelist, of course, and you do a lot of stand-up. Is there a fundamental difference between the audiences in those two settings?
Well, the beauty of being a panelist is that you've got, you know, I got Peter, I got the two other panelists. So I get to just, you know, take a break in the middle and daydream for a little bit and kind of let my head wander and let them make other people laugh. Because if you're doing that in stand-up, it's not a good thing.
You can't just stand there silently for 3 minutes?
Yeah, I haven't done that in stand-up.
So you're on your way to Wisconsin now. Peter, is Wisconsin, I know it's not far for you, is Wisconsin a foreign territory coming up the highway there?
Absolutely. It really is. It's like crossing the boundary between worlds. All of a sudden, you know, there's like topographical variation, which is amazing. I understand you folk up there in Wisconsin root for a different football team than we do here, which I find really strange.
Wait, there are other football teams?
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's weird, you know. But I'm very much about the Prime Directive. In terms of Star Trek, we try not to interfere with your quaint lifestyle. We just come in, we pretend to be one of you, and then we leave.
Now, I notice you're coming to Wisconsin in June. Maz, we couldn't get you here in our brutally cold winter this year?
I live in Los Angeles, so I don't know. I mean, my research for Wisconsin was watching Laverne and Shirley. So,
like that, yeah.
That's all I got. And, you know, I can't handle you guys' winter. Although I think I'm actually doing stand-up somewhere in Wisconsin in September or October. Should I keep that date or cancel?
Oh, that's nothing. Yeah. Fall is the best time to be here in a lot of ways. No, definitely keep that date.
Well, all right.
Peter, the state government is always trying to entice businesses to relocate to Wisconsin, maybe offering tax breaks. What would it take to get Wait, Wait to relocate up stakes and just always do it from Wisconsin?
I mean, are you offering?
Well, I mean, I'm not. I have no say. I'll take you out for brats and cheese curds. I'll throw that on the table.
Pretty much. I'll tell you, I was recently in Milwaukee, I went up to see a concert up at the Riverside Theater, which, by the way, has the finest green room in all of entertainment.
It does. I've actually been back there. It's amazing.
It's amazing. I saw my friends Nickel Creek, and it was awesome. And we found this deli, and we stocked up on Sprecher beer and sausages. And basically, I would do it if I were to get one really good Wisconsin summer sausage, like an Usinger summer sausage. Is it Usinger or Usinger? I've never known.
Usinger?
Usinger? I do it for a
I go back
sausage.
And forth.
No one has ever attracted. No one's ever trying to attract us.
Hmm.
We're remarkably cheap.
Okay, yeah, you're not pricing yourself out of the market with just one summer sausage.
Well,
yeah. Maz, we know Peter loves your accents. You're known for doing some great accents. Do you have any Wisconsin accents in your repertoire yet?
Well, you know, Peter, I guess, gets letters whenever I do accents.
Yes.
So I just got to see.
Yes, I do.
Angry, offended letters?
Yes.
No one thinks I'm doing their accents right. And I'll make sure to offend somebody else this weekend. I'm not sure who yet, but because that usually
really
comes out in the fake story, the fake news portion of the show. So I'll work on a Wisconsin accent, see if I can offend the whole audience.
Peter, you're going to say
awesome.
Something? Yeah.
No, I was going to say that my favorite part is when Moz gets angry letters for doing his bad Iranian accent. And he is Iranian, but that doesn't seem to stop people from being indignant.
Moz, you can't even get the Iranian accent right? Come on.
I'm telling you, man, these Wait, Don't Tell Me fans are really, really, they're tough critics. And I don't know what to say. I think maybe I'm going to keep doing it till they come around and accept my artistry.
Well, no, wait, is this a case where you're doing, you know, West Side accent and the East Siders from Tehran are upset? Or how are you getting the Iranian accent wrong?
Well, you know, I mean, I'll do like, I'm sure they're writing in saying that sounds like an Arab accent, you know, where, you know, if I might, like an Arab might say Wisconsin and an Iranian might say Wisconsin. You see the difference right there?
I'm not offended yet. It was a subtle difference.
That's brilliant. I mean, but they will write in and they will say, no, that was not the. I mean, I'll do all kinds. I mean, I'll do Indian Wisconsin, you know. I'll do Russian Wisconsin. They're all really bad accents. Let's just face it right now.
And are you going to have any Wisconsin topical material in your show in your visit to Wisconsin, Peter?
I think it's a good question. I mean, you guys in Wisconsin, especially since the gubernatorial election a few years ago, have provided us with a lot of material. I remember having some fun with your fugitive legislators. That was pretty awesome. And as you also know, and I don't think Charlie's doing a show up there, which is a shame, but I don't know if you guys have figured this out, but pretty much every single time Charlie Pierce is on the show and is asked to make up our story in our Bluff the Listener segment, he places it in a small town of Wisconsin. Other people have noticed. I don't know if this comes to your attention. And the reason he does this, he will tell you, is because when he was a proud student at Marquette University in Milwaukee and worked on the student paper, one of his jobs was compiling, he likes to call it, you know, the bowling scores in agate type. So he was typesetting all these sports scores from tiny towns in Wisconsin, which he professes to be able to remember. So that's why Wisconsin will always have a special place in the history of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Excellent.
I don't know. Have you guys been up to stuff? Should we be on top of it?
Nah.
What's been going on in Wisconsin?
It's pretty quiet lately. Not like it was a few years back when you're getting all that material there. Moz, do you have any good Midwestern or Wisconsin-specific stuff you want to lay on us at the show?
Well, I'm a little worried you guys had a tornado last night. What's that about?
It's true. We do get tornadoes here a couple nights ago. No fatalities, knock on wood. We'll try to keep the summer like that. So we kind of take them for granted. They're bad when they happen. And you're in L.A. We think, oh, my God, how can you live with earthquakes menacing you? They hit everybody. How, do you have exactly the opposite thing on the earthquake versus tornado continuum?
Yeah, so far, you know, knock on wood, people freak out when they find out you live in L.A., and, you know, we've done all right with the earthquakes here. And I didn't know you guys had tornadoes, though, and now I'm worried. I mean, is that a common thing, or was it kind of like a tornado light tornado? Was it just high winds? Is that what it was?
No, there was an actual tornado. It looks like a lot of houses and trees hurt, but no, and some people injured. But again, no fatalities, and hopefully we'll keep it that way this season. No, there will be tornadoes around the state of Wisconsin. Many of them in any given summer. But I would say visiting, don't lose any sleep over the tornadoes. Okay, you do that for me, Maz?
I was a little worried.
Maz, this is the upper Midwest where I live as well, and, you know, tornadoes are among the most exciting things that happen here. it's pretty awesome, actually. It's like, ooh, tornadoes,
we'll get some
of those,
it gives us something
we'll get
to
some
talk about.
Beers and those sausages and just watch the tornado.
And from the safety of our basement, yes.
That is a perfect Midwestern evening. And you guys have movie stars, we have tornadoes.
Exactly. Peter, before we run out of time, I wanted to ask about the big transition, Carl Castle moving on to the role of scorekeeper emeritus. Yeah. Do you miss him already?
Oh, constantly. I did this show with him. I mean, let's discount his amazing talent and presence. I did the show standing next to him every week for 16 years. It's really weird that he's not there. And for many, many years, he was quite literally the face of the show. And that if you were to buy Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Tchotchkes, it had his face on it. It's very strange. I mean, the show is and will be different without him. But,
do you sleep with one of those pillows with his face on it?
I do. I whisper things into his non-existent two-dimensional ear.
And now, Peter, you've got this fresh-faced kid, Bill Curtis, with you.
I think he's got a future in this business.
Excellent.
He's all eager. He's all eagerness, big ears, and freckles. Now, do you guys know who Bill Curtis is up in Wisconsin? Right?
Legendary anchorman. Yeah, I was joking about the fresh-faced rookie.
Yes, I know. And the thing is, you know, Bill is a relatively youthful, I think, 73, but he loves this. I mean, it's weird to me. I was very surprised that Bill was so willing to step in on a regular basis because, I mean, the man's accomplished so much, and he has money, and he has businesses to run, and he has a production company, and no end of demands on his time. But there's just something about, you know, standing in front of an audience every week and making fart jokes and getting a laugh that appeals to, you know, everybody, I guess.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Peter, thanks. Good to talk to you again.
You too. It's a pleasure. I'll look forward to seeing you all in Madison.
And Maz, don't worry too much about the tornadoes.
All right, I'm going to put away my tornado gear. I was ready to go, but that's fine.
That was Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sagal and panelist Maz Jobrani talking to us earlier this week. They'll both be at Madison's Overture Center tonight recording this week's quiz show before a live audience. If you'd like to attend, go to the Overture Center's website or follow the link from the WPR.org website under calendar.
News broke yesterday that the United States Patent and Trademark Office is canceling six of the trademarks belonging to Washington's professional football team. They argue that the team's name is offensive to Native Americans.
The team name in question here, Redskins, has been at the center of a heated debate in recent years, with many across the country calling on the team's owner to change the name.
Joining us to talk about the Trademark Office's decision and why he thinks the name should be banned for good is Gregory Reinhardt, a professor of anthropology at the University of Indianapolis. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Arresting Indian Imagery: Property, Magic, and Proxy in Visual Fantasies of Indianness. Gregory, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
I want to start with your reaction to the Trademark Office decision yesterday. And I have to say, I didn't even know that this was an option, that the Patent and Trademark Office looked at such things. And then I come to find out that not only do they look at things, but they've looked at this same issue before.
That's right. They looked at it in 1999 and then said that, they canceled the trademark, and then 4 years later, roughly in 2003, that decision got overturned by the courts. So it's happened already, and I spent part of today reading the entire decision through up until the dissenting person's comments, but it's a long, long piece of of decision making and impressive. So I suppose you have a more specific question for me than that.
Yeah, right now the only other specific question, because I want to get into kind of you wrote an op-ed about the term Redskins,
yeah.
And I want to hear more about your reaction to the decision. But first, sort of the mechanics of this. What does this mean right now for the Washington Redskins? Obviously, they'll be going back to court, but in terms of day-to-day business, how is it going to affect them?
As far as I understand, it will have no effect on them. They will continue to have the copyright because they're going to appeal this. And in the event that the appeal doesn't go through and the trademark is indeed canceled henceforth forevermore, then others could use the Redskins brand, the Redskins logo and name, and not be sued. But until that happens, anybody who would deign to use their logo in any form would be liable to lawsuits from them.
Well, let's get right to the heart of the matter. In an op-ed of yours I read, and I'm just going to read a sentence from it here right away and get your reaction to it. You wrote it, and I'd like to hear you explain it. Make no mistake, Redskin is racist, and it's a national embarrassment that so many people still see the term as no big deal. Talk about that. That's pretty strong stuff, and you're not really hedging anything on that.
No, I'm not hedging it. I've been looking in my own work at the issues of visual representations, which are usually stereotypes of American Indians, for the past 25, 26 years, and that's what this book gets into. But the basic idea is that we allow things to happen with, about, and toward American Indians and other Native Americans that we wouldn't permit in contemporary society for other sociocultural minorities. In other words, we let stuff pass as if it were harmless and not derogatory, not denigrating for American Indians. But, you know, nobody would sensibly do this, because it would be essentially indecent if we did this for other minority populations in the U.S., either cultural minority populations or biologically minority populations.
So why do you suppose that is? Why is there that distinction?
I think it's there in part because we have this history, this American history, that goes back to the 1500s and 1600s, but especially in the English colonies since the 1600s, of identifying ourselves as a nation with American Indians. So anytime we use an American Indian image as sort of a national icon, what we're saying is, this is America. And this essentially reduces American Indians as people to these icons that can be used any way. That's the property part of the work I'm dealing with in my book. In other words, they are negotiable property. They're tangible, and can be used any way anybody cares to, not just because of the First Amendment's free speech right, but simply because we haven't thought about it in other terms. So I think it's time in the 21st century that we do consider those other terms, which I regard as pretty much racist.
Now, and I've got a quick two-part question. We've only got a couple minutes here before we have to go to the break. But have you seen public opinion change on this topic over the last, say, 10 or 15 years? On the team side, in the NFL side, the heels are clearly dug in, and it doesn't appear that they are changing. So what do they see as being at stake here?
Well, if you read that decision, you'll see that, the documentation that the use of the word Redskins has become more derogatory in past decades. I just don't know how else to say it except that it's no longer politically correct, and it's no longer socially appropriate to use the word. You know, one of the plaintiffs in that case basically equated it with the N-word, And she said that it dehumanizes Native Americans. So I agree with that.
Good place to leave it for the break. We're talking with Gregory Reinhart about the cancellation of the trademarks belonging to Washington's professional football team. We're asking you to join in the discussion at 800-642-1234.
What do you think about this decision? Do you think team names like this one are hurtful or racist, this one in particular, or Native American-themed team names in general? Is it time for Washington to change its name? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with anthropologist Gregory Reinhart about the recent news regarding the loss of trademarks for the Washington Redskins and whether or not it's time to put an end to the team's name for good. You can join the discussion with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. 1234. And we do have listeners who would like to join in. We'll be getting to those in just a second. Before we go to that, though, I have a question. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the decision that you just read. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that decision a little bit more. Anything in there that really caught your eye, that surprised you, that you may not have expected?
Yes. One thing that surprised me was the extent to which the plaintiff, that would be the Redskins, as part of the NFL, sought in sort of semi-devious ways, one might say, to get around the issue, one of the key issues, which was whether or not the term Redskins is disparaging. And so it was sort of a selective look at the history since the 1960s through 1990s to see if and when and where, for instance, in dictionaries, the term became something that was editorially labeled as derogatory or not preferred or defamatory or things along those lines. Anyway, but the other side, the plaintiff's side, had a lot of material that substantiated their claim that in different ways, going back to the 1960s, which is part of the basis of the first argument, which is when when the Redskins started their trademark, you know, their current trademark. Going back to the 60s, they said that it wasn't a disparaging word back then, and so there's no claim. That's a principle in the law called latches, that you can't go back and claim something from the past, and you didn't do anything about it back then, but now you're doing something about it after, you know, another group, the defendant has profited from it. So does that make sense?
Yeah, and I want to pick up on the point you made about the plaintiff's argument about whether the term is disparaging or not, because that is something you hear a lot in these sorts of discussions,
sure.
Whether it's at the college or the high school or now the professional level, that issue that, well, the term really isn't disparaging. It's a term of honor or endearment or whatever they might use in that circumstance. Yep. How do you respond to that?
Well, one of the points they made in the case was that in only a few cases, a relatively small percentage, I think something like 2%, they said at one point, does the word Redskins appear in a non-sports context. In other words, apart from professional sports and high school sports and so on. And that there the incidence is probably fairly low of its use in a positive way. Most of the time when Redskins is used, it's either negative or refers to team sports. And it's changed over the years, so you don't even see Redskins used anymore to refer to American Indians. And as for honor, you know, this is, to me, essentially the worst term you can call or use to refer to an American Indian. It just, it's just terrible. It's just embarrassing.
We've got some callers who would like to join in,
sure.
And let's start with Timothy. And Timothy, what's on your mind?
Well, I think this gets to be a little bit exaggerated. My first car was a beautiful yellow and white 54 Pontiac with Pontiac's head right on the nose of the front of the car. And, you know, if you don't put a derogatory adjectives with some of these names, like I'm 100% Norwegian. I grew up in the town of Colfax where the Vikings are there. I mean, should we take away the Viking name? We're using it all the time. I mean, unless you put some adjective in front of it, I just think people are just being ridiculous to take away a name that was meant as an honorable thing. And it still is. It's just like we have different nationalities. They're good and bad and ugly in all of them. And that's not the point. We have a name like that. If it is not dishonorable, there's no reason to change it.
All right, Timothy, thanks so much for the call. Gregory Reinhart, what about that? Because, you know, you can think of the Fighting Irish, you can think of the Minnesota Vikings. Does Timothy have a point or not?
He has a point, but I don't think it's a very good one. I think it's a spurious point, mainly because Vikings doesn't have negative connotations attached to it in a modern sense. The Notre Dame leprechaun who has his fists up and is about to, looks like he's ready to strike somebody, that's not a real person, but the Redskins logo is a real person, although it's plagiarized directly from the Buffalo Nickel, which makes me wonder why the United States government isn't taxing the Redskins for the use of a plagiarized public image, though it be, but a plagiarized image.
That's
in
good.
Other words, a governor origin image.
Sure. Let's go to Carol now, and Carol joins us from Oak Creek.
Hi, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Besides the Washington Redskins, I was wondering if you would go after the Cleveland Indians, particularly their mascot. Their mascot is highly offensive because it's a caricature of a Native American person. I was wondering what you thought about the Cleveland Indians mascot.
Carol, thanks for the call. Gregory Reinhart, Cleveland Indians, and there are other examples, too, of course, in professional sports.
Well, sure. Chief Wahoo is the Cleveland Indians mascot, and it, too, is it's pretty egregious. It's a caricature, and it's not unlike African-American caricatures from early parts of the century and into the last century. But one step at a time, and I think the first big step is attacking the word Redskins head on. And I think that eventually other teams will figure out that this doesn't wash anymore. And it's principally the professional teams that still have these. You know, the Chicago Blackhawks is another example. University and college teams have almost systematically dropped their Indian mascots. And, you know, through the NCAA, those teams that participated at that level of sports were essentially forced to. I mean, the NCAA forced them to as of the August of 2005. So, in other words, Indian mascot kinds of things couldn't appear in postseason tournaments. And so that pretty much led to the death of remaining mascots at the college level.
So let me ask you there, you said that, you know, attacking the word Redskins sort of head on before you worry about the Cleveland Indians and so on. Do you see like a domino effect that if you're able to overcome or succeed in this particular battle that the other things will sort of line up and fall?
I'm that's what I'm hoping for, yes.
All right, let's go to Mike now, and Mike joins us in Sauk City.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to maybe educate the NPR listeners and everybody in the public about some more of the word Redskins that the tribal chairman of the tribe that bought the now famous advertisement last week, he said it very clearly that the connotations of Redskins refers directly to the dead bodies of the Indians when their corpses were brought in for the bounties due bounty hunters originally back in the 1800s.
And Mike, thanks for that. Gregory, let's talk about that. I don't know whether you know the origins of that word. Talk about the origins of the word that you do know and how that has shifted over time.
Okay, so the etymological origin of redskin, and this goes back to having read that decision this afternoon and morning, is in part about, it may be that Mike is correct, but I just don't know. I don't know enough about the history of the word. But it's also true that redskin originally was used in the earliest days, according to the plaintiff in the case, the Redskins team, to describe people from a particular region, a continent, a country. So in that sense, yes, it's simply a term, but it goes beyond that because it has implications in American society that are about American Indians. And the public service announcement last week, I can't remember, it was during a sporting event, said that essentially. It ended by saying, one thing we don't call ourselves is, and then they just showed a picture of the Redskins helmet.
Yeah, I heard about that ad campaign, and so it's interesting to see some of the Native American tribes coming out and taking those sort of stances. I want to ask you, you know, in terms of if progress as you see it, do you see this decision by the Patent and Trademark Office as being progress, or do you see this as a smallish step towards something?
I see it as progress. It's incremental. These kinds of decisions and changes in attitude take time. We long ago changed our attitudes about African Americans and about Asian Americans, and it's just taking longer because the concept of American Indian is so enmeshed with and intertwined with American society that it's hard to extricate one idea about them from others. And you know, I keep coming back to Redskins as a really defamatory word.
Well, Gregory, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. I'm glad I could help.
Gregory Reinhart is a professor of anthropology at the University of Indianapolis. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Arresting Indian Imagery, Property, Magic, and Proxy in Visual Fantasies of Indianness.
Now, Gene, before we get to that, I'm going to ask you, What is your greatest fear?
Oh, golly, Rob, I don't know. Maybe a shark attack?
All right, that was just some shtick there. You're probably safe here in Wisconsin, too, barring Sharknado, of course.
Of course.
Well, tomorrow, June 20th, marks the anniversary of the release of the film Jaws in 1975, considered the first summer blockbuster ever, close to $500 million grossed, that much, with only a $9 million budget. It played on our most primal fears and spawned a whole industry of summer films that did something like that.
So today, to mark that anniversary in our weekly Share Something segment, we're asking you to share your greatest fear with us. Is it a fear of heights, a fear of something paranormal? Are you terrified of large bodies of water or maybe even sharks? Share a story with us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And is there a movie to match your fear? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. To kick us off, though, we have Central Time producer Galen Druk. Galen, we've asked our listeners, I'm going to ask you, I know you have one, what is your big fear?
It's actually pretty basic. I'm horrified of flying in a very basic, non-complicated, I hate flying, I never want to do it kind of way.
But you do it. You've traveled across the Atlantic Ocean, I think not on a tramp steamer.
Right, exactly. Actually, that's when I realized that I was horrified of flying. I was mid-Atlantic, 30,000 feet in the sky, and started panicking and shaking, and I was almost in tears, and this really nice woman sitting next to me had no idea what was going on, and I had to explain to her that I was really terrified of flying.
So it's not about the long lines. It's not about going through security. It's something about being in the air and realizing that heavier than aircraft actually cannot fly, or
is it
what
the isolation?
Is it? Yeah.
Well, no, it's kind of, it just feels so unnatural. It's probably the one thing that I do in my life that I feel like I should never be doing. And then also there's just so many things that could go wrong because I know nothing about flying. You know, I think one of my fears is like, what if the pilot just decides he wants to keep going up? You know, mm-hmm. what happens then? That's horrifying.
So is this something that you always sort of intellectually knew, but you didn't?
No, it was very random. I thought I was totally fine with flying and I did it a lot until one day I wasn't. And then since then, I haven't been okay with it.
And so what do you do now?
A glass of wine always helps. I think one thing that really helps the most is sitting next to somebody talkative. It kind of, you know, like getting into a conversation will take your mind off of whatever you're afraid of. But yeah. And then when it comes to movies made about fears of flying, I don't know. I couldn't think of really that many. I could think of Snakes on a Plane, and that's not really specifically about
it's
flying.
More the snakes, yeah.
That's just being stuck in a situation that you can't get out
of.
Or
the bad movies.
Yeah.
Well, that's a fairly common fear, Galen's fear of flying. What's yours? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We've got Steele in Appleton helping us out. Steele, what is your fear?
Yeah, my biggest fear is seeing people texting while driving in the cars, and this is one thing I'll never do again. I was at a red light, and I used to instruct in gliders where a person sits behind the other person, and you see the head down, and I honked the horn, and that person started to drive until she realized it was a red light.
Oh.
And just everyone, you know, we have these laws, and it terrifies me.
Well, and so that's, I mean, in a way, that's a very reasonable fear. Texting causes real crashes, but do you think you feel a fear above and beyond the normal, you know, the basic obvious problem there?
No, I'm no? just, I think there's laws there, and I bet you Wisconsin doesn't even have one ticket for that.
Steele, thanks for the call. 800-642-1234. Galen just reminded me there is a movie to match that.
Yeah, it's actually the Werner Herzog documentary that came out, I think, last year. Right?
Yeah, we talked about it on the show, and watching some of that, it was scary meeting the people who had survived crashes or their relatives if they didn't survive. A very rational fear. Thanks for the call, Steele. You can share your fear, your phobia at 800-642-1234.
All right. We've heard from Dan on Facebook, and Dan writes, and you know, this is kind of a common fear, I think. I have a fear that whenever I'm driving over a railroad track, even when I can't see a train, one will come hurtling down the track at 800 miles an hour and smash my car to pieces. I don't think there's a movie about that, though, and I don't think there is a movie about that, but I think that is sort of a commonish fear because, you know, I've been at a railroad track, and you look left, and you look right, and you look left, and you look right, and then you look left again, and then eventually you go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a thank you so much for sharing that, Dan, on the Central Time Facebook page. You know, I didn't think I had one. I just realized what mine is. I'm not scared of heights
mm-hmm.
myself. I can stand and look from a high distance. I can't stand and look at someone else on the edge of heights. Then I get panicky and nervous. That's I think I'm going to nominate that as my thing.
I have the movie for you then.
What is it?
It's Man on Wire. I think.
Oh,
it's
no.
Called.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's the documentary about the guy who tightrope walked between the
right.
two World Trade Towers.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I could watch that.
I don't
that
think
was
so
intense.
Either. Well, all right, let's go to the phones right now. We've got some folks who would like to weigh in, and we begin with Barbara from Superior. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. My fear is losing my physical ability to take care of myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in my mid-60s. My mind is very, very good, but my body is slowing down. That's what is one of my biggest fears.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Barbara. We just talked a week or so ago. Councils on Aging around the state can hook you up with exercise programs that can help stave off that fear. Barbara, thank you for sharing that, and good luck to you. We'll go now to Lucy with us in Black Creek. Lucy, hi.
Hello there.
What do you got for us? What's your fear, Lucy?
Driving over bridges.
Oh, boy. That's a good one. Tell us why, like, a long bridge, short bridge, does it make a difference?
Bridges over water or high bridges.
Sure. Have you been over, like, the Mackinac Bridge or the Golden Gate or anything like that?
Yes, I've been across the Mackinac Bridge. I went across a bridge in Louisiana going over Lake Charles, which was just insane. Oh, my gosh.
And, Lucy, are you cringing just talking about these bridges?
Yep.
I can hear it.
I can hear it, too, and I have a story about the Mackinac Bridge I'll share with you sometime. It
was high wind involved?
High wind, and a motorcycle was involved, and it was terrifying, and I'll just leave it right there. Lucy, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Jenny now, and Jenny is with us from Hurley. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
What's your fear, Jenny?
My fear is tripping and falling while I'm walking, and it's to the point where I hardly look forward. I look more down as I'm walking, and it has transferred over to my daughter. I am always so cautious with her or anybody that I'm walking with. I'm constantly looking ahead for a spot where you could trip and fall.
Did you have a bad fall once, Jenny, or is this just something you developed?
Well, no, I did. I fell. Well, I didn't. It wasn't that I fell. I broke my foot while I was dancing, and then 3 months later, I stepped into a divot and broke my ankle same leg. So it's just it's like overpowering. Like I can't go somewhere without looking down constantly, and also being very cautious with other people, bringing that fear onto them and telling them, "Be careful. There's a be careful of that curb. Be careful of that crack." It's like, I'm crazy.
Well, Jenny, you don't sound crazy to us. Thanks for the call so much. We've got time for a very quick call from Sydney, who joins us from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Sydney.
Hi. Okay, I've got a little bit of a rational fear, and it's a little bit weird. I don't know if it's my greatest, but it's definitely a fear. It's the fear of butterflies. And it started with us going to a trip to a museum that had a lot of butterflies in it, and I just felt overwhelmed. And so now I just flinch when I see a butterfly.
Okay, that's a good one, Sydney. Thanks for that.
Thanks, Sydney, and thanks to all of you for your calls. And Galen, thanks to you as well.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on.